dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. It's difficult for many people to accept that individuals at the highest level of government could have had foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks and deliberately fail to act to prevent them in order to create a pretext for a series of imperial wars. Yet last week we presented a history showing that the government has actually gone farther than that by carrying out terrorist acts against civilian targets in pursuit of putting down political movements that challenge the American empire abroad. In spite of this history, those who raise the question of government complicity in 9/11 are dismissed out of hand, while, for example, the government's claim to have found the passport of alleged lead hijacker Mohammed Atta at Ground Zero, after it supposedly survived a fireball hot enough to bring down a steel skyscraper, is not challenged as just a wee bit unbelievable. Why not? If you question the official story, you are accusing the government of lying, and you must then delve into why. Asking why might start a domino effect that would reveal the underpinnings of what we like to celebrate as the land of the free. Remaining human in the face of this reality is the subject of the second hour, as we bring you a speech by Robert Jensen, activist and journalist. In our first hour, we'll continue to address questions still unanswered and perhaps unasked by the official investigation of 9/11. Our first speaker, Jim Hoffman, has focused for the past year on the collapse of the Twin Towers as well as the World Trade Center Building 7. He rejects the official story that the structures collapsed as a result of the impact of the planes and subsequent fires. You will have to decide whether the points Hoffman raises in the presentation we're about to hear have merit. His issues are very technical in many cases, and his presentation was accompanied by images that we don't have the benefit of on radio. Hoffman is not an expert in building demolition, though he does have some background in combustion engineering. He makes his living as a software engineer. Here was his presentation from the International Grassroots Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11 held last March in San Francisco. He begins by examining the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7.
Building 7 totally collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11/01. And whereas the collapse of the Twin Towers was the subject of expensive PR campaigns to explain how they simply fell down, Building 7 has thus far required no such PR campaign. Building 7 totally collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. It slid down into its footprint in a smooth motion that was so quick that the entire process took only 6.5 seconds to complete. That's only a fraction of a second greater than it would take a rock drop from the top of the building to fall in a vacuum. So virtually all the resistance in this building had to be eliminated almost instantly to achieve this vertical collapse. You can see in this photograph how the building remains perfectly aligned as it just glides into its footprint. Now, unfortunately, the most convincing thing is to actually watch the videos. Unfortunately, I'm having technical problems and I can't play the videos now, but I encourage if you're interested, to go upstairs at 6:30 this evening, and hopefully by then I'll have another laptop and I can play some of these videos. The videos also work on my site, WTC7.net, which I encourage you to go to. Now, not only did this entire rubble pile was basically confined to the city block on which Building 7 sat, piled up high in the middle, the outer walls lying on top, characteristic of a controlled demolition, and the entire pile was only two stories high. This building was so thoroughly destroyed. Now, it's a considerable engineering feat to take such a tall structure down into its footprint. Now, perhaps you're thinking, well, was it the ancillary damage from the collapse of the Twin Towers that was responsible for the collapse of this building? Well, actually, Building 7 was on a separate block from the rest of the World Trade Center complex. It was 300 feet away from the North Tower, which was the nearest of the two towers that collapsed. And Building 7, although a World Trade Center building in address, was built over 10 years later than the towers. It was a different architectural style, had different owners up to just a few weeks before the attack. And it was across the street, and it wasn't even that close to the towers. Now, if you look at the fallout pattern from the destruction of the towers, which FEMA documented in its report, this is Building 6, the building that's in between the North Tower and World Trade Center 7, it shows that, and you can clearly see, this is Building 6 here, it has this big crater because all this heavy rubble from the North Tower fell on it, but here's Building 7, an entirely separate block, and as you can see, the vast majority of heavy fallout didn't even reach Building 7. So Building 7, there's no evidence that it was significantly damaged, certainly not structurally damaged, by the collapse of the North Tower. Now, fire is blamed for the total collapse of this building. But if that were the case, it would be the first time in history that fire was ever blamed for the total collapse, or even partial collapse, of a steel frame building, or certainly a steel frame high-rise. And moreover, the fires in Building 7 weren't even very severe. They were just isolated on about two floors and just burned continuously, but they never spread even to other parts of the floors. Now, history provides us with numerous examples of other buildings that have been ravaged, steel frame high-rises, skyscrapers that have been ravaged by severe fires that have gone on for many hours. In 1991, the Meridian Plaza fire in Philadelphia raged for 18 hours, gutted eight floors of this 38-floor building, and the 1988 First Interstate Bank building fire in Los Angeles burned for 3.5 hours and gutted four floors, fairly low in this building. And in both cases, they didn't produce any critical structural damage in this building. In fact, a company specializing in analyzing these kinds of incidents said that there were no damage to the main structural members in the First Interstate Bank building fire. I'm going to be talking more about the fire temperatures and things when I get to the Twin Towers part of this talk. Now, if fires could have destroyed this huge steel skyscraper, shouldn't this have been news? I mean, wouldn't all high-rise steel buildings be suspect? And are firefighters going to rush into buildings to protect life and property, given that now puny fires can level a huge skyscraper? Well, and yet this story has never even reached the public consciousness. So, it should have been carefully investigated. I mean, this was the greatest engineering failure in world history, with the possible exception of the collapses of the Twin Towers a few hours before. So shouldn't the evidence have been carefully examined? And I'll talk more about what actually happened to the evidence in the Twin Towers part of this talk. But what I did want to point out is that the only government agency that reported in any detail or that even pretended to investigate the collapse of World Trade Center 7 said in their report that the specifics of the fires in WTC 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Further research, investigation, and analysis are needed to resolve this issue. Well, unfortunately, by the time they released that report in May of 2002, the evidence had all been destroyed, the physical evidence being the structural steel that was holding up this building. So it had been destroyed, and these volunteer investigators who were supposed to, tried to understand what happened, and they couldn't figure it out, weren't even allowed access to Ground Zero, where the actual evidence was. Moreover, I want to point out that in the case of Building 7, unlike the towers, the rubble pile was so neatly confined to the footprint of this building that they could have even cleared adjacent roads without disturbing the main part of the rubble pile. They could have, certainly this is as important as any archaeological dig. They should have had grids. They should have moved the stuff to a warehouse for careful examination. Instead, they just destroyed it. Now, what could have caused the collapse of such a large building? Note that this building is five times as tall as it is deep. It's a tall vertical structure. Do vertical steel structures just fall straight into their footprints and just fold into themselves and rip themselves apart? I don't think so, because in order to bring such a tall vertical structure down, you would basically have to destroy all 58 perimeter columns and all 25 core columns of this building simultaneously, because unless you did that, such a tall structure would topple one way or the other. It's basic physics, it's basic common sense that vertical objects, if they're damaged, they don't, fall through themselves. They would tip over, especially if the damage was localized to the lower parts of this building, which is where the fires were. Any asymmetry and damage to this building would cause such a building to topple, not to just, fall neatly into its footprint. So even if you can buy bizarre theories about diesel tanks exploding, there were large diesel tanks in this building, if you could somehow get a diesel tank to explode, and even if there were large random explosions, it wouldn't cause such a structure to just fall into itself. Only controlled demolitions have been able to do that. And that's, like I said, it's a considerable engineering feat to bring such a large structure down into its footprint, and it requires precise timing of the explosions, delivering the damage simultaneously to all the vertical structures in this building, not just all the columns, but up the building as well, so that the building won't topple to one side or the other. Now, in addition to this logical argument that I've just laid out, note that there's signature features of a controlled demolition. You see these streamers. This is the building about halfway through its 6.5-second collapse. These streamers of dust. There weren't any fires in this part of the building. This is the north facade. There was no damage to this building before it suddenly collapsed. And you can these look like explosive charges just went off. There's additional evidence that, you know, very direct evidence that this was an explosive demolition. Now, Building 7 is very interesting in that it was shrouded in secrecy. It had a very short tenant list that was entirely financial institutions and government agencies. And most interestingly, it was the headquarters of Giuliani's secret command, or his emergency command center, which was outfitted in 1998 with bullet and bob resistant windows, an independent secure air and water supply, and the ability to withstand winds of 160 miles per hour. So up here on the 23rd floor was this emergency command center that would have been the ideal location from which to supervise the response to the September 11th emergency, but instead, supposedly, the building was evacuated even before the towers began to collapse, and Mayor Giuliani didn't even go to Building 7, apparently, on September 11th, and they even withdrew the firefighters, or there were no manual attempts to fight the small fires in Building 7. So my conclusion is that Building 7 was deliberately demolished because there's no other explanation. Now, with that, I would like to go to another segment before I go to the Twin Towers, because the first part of the talk about the Twin Towers is all about the non sequiturs in the official explanation and how the official explanation that the collision damage and the fires brought these buildings down. But I think it's important to actually look at the evidence at the photographs and have that in your mind when I go through the first part of this talk. And I'll be talking more about the physical evidence, what really happened later. But let's just go through and look at what really happened to these buildings. The North Tower was hit. The North Tower, smoke is coming out. The fires burn in the North Tower. Then, and that was at 8:46 a.m. that it was hit. This is the impact hole. And so the South Tower, by the time the South Tower was hit, people had their cameras trained on the building. So this was by far the most widely played image, the images of the spectacular fireball from the Flight 175 hitting the South Tower at 9:02 a.m. The South Tower, like both towers, burned fairly well as long as the jet fuel remained. But once the jet fuel burned off in about 5 minutes, the smoke became darker. And the fires, particularly in the South Tower, didn't burn very vigorously after the first few minutes. And by the time the building collapsed, notice the dark smoke here, which is a sign of oxygen-starved fires. All this damage that you see to this building here is mostly the aluminum cladding. There weren't actually any broken columns on the side, steel columns on the side of the building. And then at 9:59 a.m., all of a sudden, the top of the South Tower begins to lean. And then before it even, you know, it looks like it's going to topple. But instead of toppling, all of a sudden, the whole top just starts to disintegrate and just puff out into this huge cloud, this explosive cloud of dust that just consumed the tower. And we never saw that top again. It just starts exploding into fine dust and shattered steel. Here's the South Tower at 7 seconds into this event. It's just, you know, just blowing up. These clouds are expanding at about 50 feet a second. And here it is at 8 seconds. I'm seeing it from the south. You can see Building 7 in the background. Here it is from the southwest. And here it is at about 10 seconds. The building is only about half gone. But already, the volume of this huge exploding dust cloud is several times the volume of the building. Here it is a few seconds later. The destruction has reached the ground. Here it has completely reached the ground. We see the persistence of part of the core structure, which then just disintegrates a few seconds later. And the North Tower continues to burn, actually at a greater rate after the fall of the South Tower. And it, whereas the South Tower only lasted for 56 minutes, the North Tower, which had much more severe damage, although the hit was much higher up, lasted for 102 minutes before it began its precipitous collapse. Here it is 4 seconds into the collapse. Again, you see this, you know, the very similar to the South Tower, just exploding cloud of dust, just the tower just being completely shattered and shredded as this expanding cloud just travels down the tower, just consuming all this intact structure and just turning it into rubble in midair. And then the final event of the day is the collapse of Building 7. And again, you see it just go straight down into its footprint. And the historical revision would begin immediately because and here's the New York Times headline the next day. And what does it say? Hijackers rammed jetliners into each of New York's World Trade Center towers yesterday, toppling both in a hellish storm of ash, glass, smoke, and leaping victims. So it was all one event. Okay, the plane hits it and the building topples. Well, that's not the way it happened. So now let's go to the Twin Towers talk. And I, about April 3rd, I plan to consolidate these talks called the Extended Remix. That'll go on for an hour about this. Now, so the Twin Towers, I think this is the core, to me it's the most important issue of the 9/11 attack, because to me it's the core of the big lie. If these towers were demolished, then the entire official story falls apart, because Osama bin Laden did not have the means to destroy these buildings. If it was not by, you know, a consequence of the jetliner impacts. Demolition, I note, is an all or nothing proposition. You can't be half pregnant, you can't have a halfway demolition job. So let's scrutinize the official story and go through a whole series, look at the official story, and at the end I'll get back to the physical evidence and show you how that's just completely incongruous with what we're supposed to believe happened. And I want to just comment on the sequence of events that happened on September 11th, which I've already talked a little bit about, and that you had a series of events that escalated to ever greater levels of incredibleness and shockingness. You had planes being taken over supposedly by hijackers with primitive weapons in four cases, and airplanes that had, you know, experience like Vietnam veteran, you know, pilots, and you know, none of them even pressed the hijacker code in the jetliners. And then you have the signature World Trade Center towers being smashed into by airplanes, and then in the meantime, the Pentagon, half an hour later, gets hit. Supposedly, what should have been the best defended building in the whole world is just like wide open to attack, even though the attack has been unfolding for almost an hour and a half. So that my point here is that by the time we get to these buildings just exploding into dust just instantly exploding into dust, I think that the reason that people bought the official story that these buildings just fell down is that people were in a state of shock, such a state of shock, having seen so many incredible events leading up to this, that they were just willing to accept whatever the news anchors were telling them. And the news anchors never screwed up. They always said, the buildings fell down, those buildings collapsed. You never heard them, any speculation about that the buildings were exploded. So what's wrong with this official story that they collapsed? Well, I've talked about this in the Building 7 segment, in that fires have never destroyed a steel frame high rise. In fact, they never even damaged a vertical column in any of these buildings. And there have been, the severe cases that have gone on for, a whole day, and they didn't even destroy these buildings. So FEMA was entrusted with the sole responsibility to investigate the three largest engineering failures in the history of the world. And what did they do? They appointed a team of volunteer investigators from the American Society of Civil Engineers, and they didn't even fund an independent investigation. They only allocated $600,000 to this entire investigation. And these volunteer investigators didn't even see a single piece of steel for at least 3 weeks after the attack. And they weren't allowed access to Ground Zero except for what was described as one guided tour. Meanwhile, they were shunted off in the salvage yards and got to see a few pieces of steel that they were allowed to see go by there. Meanwhile, the vast bulk of the steel was being loaded onto barges and shipped to India and China, where they were presumably going into blast furnaces, where they wouldn't be terribly, the steel after it's been through a blast furnace wouldn't be terribly valuable to an investigation. By the time they published their report called the World Trade Center Building Performance Study, Ground Zero had been completely scrubbed, so there's no more of the physical evidence. And the report only really pretended to explain the North Tower collapse. And then it applies the same argument to the South Tower, even though it was actually quite different, and they admit that they were clueless about Building 7. The destruction of evidence was very systematic. The city accepted a plan from Controlled Demolition Incorporated for recycling the steel a mere 11 days after the attack, and they began to put it into effect very quickly. The steel was sold to scrap metal vendors for a low cost, and it was being shipped out. New infrastructure was built to expedite the process in the form of new docks. And people were anybody trying to investigate Ground Zero was prevented from doing so. People were threatened with arrest for even taking photographs of Ground Zero. And this evidence destruction operation was protested by victims' family members and respected people in the firefighting community, like Bill Manning. Now, a series of explanations was promoted to explain the collapses. not just one explanation, but a series of explanations, starting out with ridiculous explanations and then becoming more sophisticated as time went on and as the need arose to have explanations that would address what was so ludicrous about the first ones. Because the first one I call the core meltdown theory or killer fires theory, and that's the one that's still probably dominant in most people's mind, that the intense fires simply melted the steel. And Chris Weiss, who is a structural engineer, supposedly was quoted by the BBC as saying, it was the fire that killed the buildings. There's nothing on earth that could have survived those temperatures with that amount of fuel burning. The columns would have melted, the floors would have melted, and everything would have collapsed one on top of the other. But that's rather bizarre for a structural engineer to say, because the melting point of steel is 1,535 degrees Celsius, and about the highest temperature you can attain. Burning hydrocarbons in the atmosphere without systematic pressurization or preheating is about 825 degrees Celsius. So there's, you know, kind of a big gap between those two. Moreover, that's if you have a mixture of fuel and air. See, the blue flame, that's about how hot the flame on a stove is, the blue flame. And if you have a diffuse flame, like in a building fire where you have orange flames, those are hundreds of degrees cooler than this, you know, these high, the temperature of 825 degrees Celsius. So it's just a huge impossibility. So the next theory that was introduced was the column failure theory, in which the fires don't supposedly melt the columns, but they soften them up to the point where you get this chain reaction of failures and this collapse. And this was endorsed in a paper called Why Did the World Trade Center Collapse? Simple Analysis. This paper, it's like an academic paper, it's like this mathematical theory they call elastic dynamic analysis, was published a mere 2 days after the attack. I wonder what kind of peer review process that paper had. And yet, they have all this thick notation in there and everything, but it looks like complete nonsense to me. I see no evidence in the paper that they understood how many columns were in the building, that they understood how thick the columns were. You know, it's just completely bizarre. And they even say things that make no sense from a structural engineering perspective, like you'd have to have half the columns fail on one floor, and then the whole thing would start to fail, you know. And actually, over design ratios are more like 3 to 1 or 5 to 1. And they describe their analysis as simple as an approximate, and yet nobody else has even apparently attempted to do a quantitative analysis. So I guess these geniuses were just so brilliant that all the questions were answered, and we didn't need any further analysis. Now note that even if you accept their abstract theory, note that they assume that all the columns on a single floor were raised to 800 degrees Celsius. But notice that in neither tower, the fires didn't even cover a single floor in either tower, certainly not the south tower, where the fires never even spread to the other side of the building. None of the features of even 700 Celsius plus fires were observed, such as you could see the steel glow red hot even in broad daylight, you'd see extensive ongoing window breakage, you'd have bright emergent flames, and you'd see light smoke, not this black smoke that became blacker over time that we actually saw. I've already talked about fires have never caused a column failure. But even more telling is that even if the fires were 800-900 degrees Celsius and they burned for a long time, it's quite another matter to heat the steel up to that temperature, because steel has a high thermal conductivity. As you pour heat onto it, it soaks the heat away. And there's, you know, 90,000 tons of steel in these buildings, so it would just wick the temperature away. Corus Construction Company performed extensive tests subjecting uninsulated steel frame car parks to prolonged hydrocarbon fires, diesel fuel, gasoline, those kind of things. And the highest temperature they recorded in any of these experiments was 360 degrees Celsius. That's about 900 degrees Fahrenheit lower than the temperature that Bazin and Joe would have to have all the columns on a single on a floor raised to. Now note that even if you could accept all this argument about the columns could have gotten that hot and everything, despite the blatant contradiction with the evidence, that would not have leveled the towers, because you'd have to have all those columns weakened to the point of collapse simultaneously to get this kind of telescoping collapse that you see in the North Tower or even the South Tower. Asymmetric damage can't produce such a result, even if you could get high enough temperatures or whatnot. So it just doesn't make any sense. So a more sophisticated theory was trotted out in order to answer these objections, called the truss failure theory. And because you can't see the trusses, which are these lightweight steel structures that underlay the floor slabs, which are these rings that span the distance between the core structures of these buildings and the outer perimeters, because you can't actually see these, maybe you can imagine a scenario in which they get red hot and they're glowing hot and they start to sag, and then you have this chain reaction of events. And one of the most eager proponents of this theory was Professor Thomas Eagar, who's a material science professor at MIT. And there's an interview with him by Nova on a website, which I have a critique of on mine. And he says, once you start to get angle clips to fail in one area, which is a misnomer for the structures that held up the perimeters of these floor slabs, it put extra load on the other end of angle clips and then it unzipped around the building on that floor in a matter of seconds. So I call that the zipper theory. And he suggested, and this is what I really like, he suggests that the towers were only designed to survive a trash can fire. So if it only occurred on one corner, such as a trash can caught on fire, you might have had to repair that corner, but the whole building wouldn't have come crashing down. The problem is it was such a widely distributed fire, and then you got this domino effect. So the key here is to think about buildings being like zippers and dominoes. You start, something collapses, and the whole thing just falls apart. The building is just waiting to throw itself apart. What's really telling about the Nova interview is not even so much the text, but the images, because the images can kind of communicate to people on a subconscious level, and they don't even see, I have even less idea that they're being lied to. Notice in this this nice little animation where all the dust, there's no dust or anything like that. It's just these floors trusses falling in this chain reaction. Well, they note that they omit the cross trusses. The trusses were actually interwoven with cross trusses at 90 degree angles, and so they were stitched together and formed a unified structure. Also, the tops of the trusses were bolted to the floor pans underlying the slabs every few inches, so it was just one big structure. It couldn't just unzip like that. I really like the structural schematic here in which the core structure of the building is represented not as a vertical bundle of columns, but as horizontal slabs, all the better for pancaking. And they also omit the spandrel plates that tied together the perimeter of columns. Finally, in this graphic of a plane approaching, the plane is the actual dimensions relative to the tower of a 747, which is over twice the gross weight of a 767 of the type that actually hit them. Now, FEMA would also promote the FEMA is the FEMA's official report. The World Trade Center Building Performance Study is the one, like the last word on the buildings. This answers all the questions. So this uses very much the same kind of deceptive techniques as EAGER does. EAGER targeting the general populace, and FEMA more for government purposes of explaining the collapses. And I think the key deception, again, in FEMA's report is to make you think the core structures didn't even exist. Notice in this graphic here, this looks like the whole building. One wall here, one wall here, right? Okay, the floors? No, actually, this is the outer part of the core. So you'd have the floor here, the core structure here, then way over here would be other floor structures. But, if you just glance at the image, it just looks like, there's just floors. There's no core structure there. And they refer to the core structure not as a structure, but as the service core. And, it's just a bunch of elevators and stuff. Oh, forget about those huge steel columns in there. And this is really good. The key passage in the entire report that explains the collapses is really telling. As the floors collapsed, this left tall freestanding portions of the exterior wall and possibly central core columns, the unsupported height, blah, 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 and they start to collapse. Now, and possibly central core columns, that's the key. You have to get the core to collapse to have the building collapse, and they're not even willing to commit to knowing that the cores, they're like using this legalistic language to cover themselves because they know it's a fraud, and they're just, they're concerned that the truth is eventually going to come out. Furthermore, neither the core structure nor the exterior columns were freestanding. The exterior columns were stitched together with those huge spandrel plates 4 feet high on every floor, and the core columns had all kinds of cross-bracing structures, so they weren't freestanding. And even if they were, does a flagpole, which is freestanding, does it rip itself apart if you take the scaffolding away? Anyway, FEMA's this misrepresentation is throughout the report. Notice in this graphic here, the core columns are depicted at about a third their actual dimensions. And, of course, they don't show the cross-bracing or anything like that. So that's the key deception. If you actually look what the cores actually look like, there were these highly cross-braced structures, these huge box columns. They ran the vertical length of the building. They were welded together. And then here's the exterior. So the core itself was capable of supporting the entire weight of the building. It was anchored directly to bedrock. It was fabricated of steel. It was 4 inches thick at the base of the tower. And these were 36 inches by 60 inches, and there were 47 of them. So they just saw, resilient steel. So the truss failure theory is just a diversion because if you play the theory out, if you say, okay, what happens if the floors fall away? Well, you don't get total building collapse because what would happen is the floors would slide down around the core like records on a spindle. You'd have both the exterior columns and the core structure remaining standing, no building collapse. And even if you did have some kind of stresses to those structures, they wouldn't have thrown themselves apart at such a fast rate that you saw no part of the building surviving above those dust clouds that the buildings were exploding into. Furthermore, there must have been large I-beams for transferring the loads between the core structure and the outer columns. So they misrepresent the building. They don't even account for all the steel that was known to have gone into the building. It's just a complete whitewash. So these official explanations are just, they just can't even begin to explain a total collapse, even if you completely ignore all this evidence of the you see the building is exploding into dust. Even if you ignore that, you can't get these theories to work to explain any kind of collapse. But then what's even more damning is to look at what the evidence really shows. And it shows that, that's what I talked about earlier. But one, I'm going to conclude later on, okay, with the progressive collapse. Well, no, I'll just talk about this now. Because, well, okay, suppose a building really could undergo this process of progressive collapse that they, you know, this academic sounding term that they describe it as. Well, if that's true, then shouldn't we be able to build another structure that would exhibit that behavior? So my challenge is build a structure that's 7 times as tall as it is wide. It can be made out of anything, toothpicks, anything you want, you know, food, and then disturb it at the top, and the structure has to rip itself apart, and that destruction has to travel to the ground. But the really hard part of the challenge is this structure. I mean, you could maybe build a house of cards that would do that, but the problem is this structure also has to be able to survive 100-mile-an-hour crosswinds. Okay, so 100-mile crosswinds, and then if you disturb it from the top, you know, take a blowtorch to the top, chop off the top, it'll just destroy itself from the top down. I bet, you know, anybody that can do this, I would really want to hear about it. Oh, I think in terms of actual scenarios of how it was accomplished, I don't have time to go into that now, but maybe I can address that later in the session upstairs at 6:30. Okay, because I have a lot more to cover here. So the evidence the evidence surviving the cleanup operation consisted of all the photographs and videos, and those are a form of physical evidence because you can make quantitative assessments based on those, like how fast the dust clouds expand, how much dust there was, you know, what remained in the rubble, and all kinds of stuff like that. Though that is, you know, hard evidence of what actually happened, even though they actually destroyed the steel and everything, it's still pretty obvious what happened. So let's just look through it briefly. What happened? So you had explosive ejection of dust and pieces. Just, you know, like I said, 50 feet a second. There were actually high velocity squibs emerging from the building at as much as 200 feet a second, and those are characteristic features of explosive demolition. So the steel, moreover, was thoroughly cleansed of its spray on insulation. All the steel had a couple inches of spray on insulation throughout the building, and that there was just no evidence of that at ground zero. The blast pressures were so great that they just blew away all the insulation. It was mixed within the fine dust that was all over lower Manhattan. The pieces of the perimeter wall were thrown as much as 500 feet laterally. This is a gash in World Financial Center 3. This is about 400 feet up and about 400 feet from the North Tower. The aluminum cladding was blown as much as 500 feet in all directions. All the perimeter columns were covered with aluminum cladding. And what's particularly important to note here is that, yes, this looks like just a big explosion, and it was, but it was not a discrete explosion or a series of discrete explosions. Rather, it was a continuous wave explosion because these buildings exploded in a single event that lasted for 15 seconds. And I think that's key to why people don't get it about that these buildings were blown up, because if they heard a shockwave, you know, bang, huge boom, they would think explosion. But because they just gradually, you know, disintegrate into dust, even though the velocities were quite high, 50 feet per second is a pretty explosive event. But because they're so large, you don't get a sense of how fast they're exploding. Just, you know, just continuous events that sounded like kind of like white noise, like an ocean wave, just a like that. I played on a movie, you could hear it. Now the tops mushroomed into these, you know, huge clouds, and they just traveled down the towers and remained perfectly centered as they traveled down the towers. Even in the case of the South Tower, which started at tip, well, then about 7 seconds into the collapse, you see no evidence of the top. And the top, which was leaning over more than 100 feet over the side of the building, never emerged from the cloud because it was completely pulverized in midair. So that they remain completely symmetric all the way down, which is a complete non sequitur again from the point of view of the official explanation, because how can something fall following the path of maximum resistance, going right down the center where there's 1,000 feet of vertical intact structure? Makes no sense. So the clouds of dust that these exploded into were comparable to the pyroclastic flows of volcanoes, which is a dense slurry of highly pulverized material, a suspension, which is so dense that it behaves as a separate fluid from the surrounding air, so it doesn't mix very much with the surrounding air, and they just expanded and traveled down the streets at about 30 miles an hour and actually picked up people and carried them, like this report from this photographer, David Hanschus, says. He says, picked them up and carried them about a block. And all the non-metallic components of these buildings were thoroughly pulverized in midair. But if you look at ground zero, all there was basically metal pieces that were shredded into short pieces and fine dust that was mostly sub-100 micron powder. Now a human hair is about 200 or 300 microns in diameter. So this is finer than a human hair. It's like talcum powder. And, you know, reports are consistent. There wasn't gravel or anything. All the 90,000 tons of concrete in these buildings were just thoroughly pulverized, as was the glass. There weren't shards of glass. It was just converted to microscopic particles. The steel structure was shredded too. There weren't any assemblies that were more than about 30 feet long in the rubble. I mean, it was very convenient because it was chopped up into short enough pieces that could be loaded onto the equipment that was hauling all the stuff away from Ground Zero and disposing of it. And even the and like the perimeter columns, these prefabricated sections of 3-story high by 3-column wide sections, were all, so many of those were just ripped apart at the welds. That's how great the destructive forces in this event were. And I'm talking about thoroughly throughout the building, not just like where the crash zone was, but throughout the building this happened. Intense heat persisted for months. Temperatures greater temperatures great enough to melt steel were in the rubble pile. When they excavated the steel, the rubble pile, they found pools of previously molten steel. Now, there's no way that a residual hydrocarbon-fueled fires could do that. So finally, I have some proofs of demolition. I only have 5 minutes to get through these. So these are kind of outlines of proof. The second one, the first two are basically common sense. And the second one, I think, is, or the first two, I think, are the most understandable. So that, see what you think of these. So as I've been saying, you can see from these thick, opaque clouds that start puffing out of these buildings and evolving within the first few seconds of these events, that these buildings were being converted to dust, not when they reached the ground, but in the air, that they were being, that all the concrete in these buildings was being pulverized. Now think about it. You have this, the tops of these buildings just falling a few feet a second in the first second, you know, gravitational acceleration, which they're falling about that rapidly, is 32 feet per second squared. So even after 2 seconds, they're only falling at about 64 feet per second. Now, and yet, would that be enough force to thoroughly pulverize all the concrete on the in the floor slabs of these buildings? Well, do the following thought experiment. Imagine taking a block of concrete and dropping it from a few floors, and it would reach that speed, maybe. Would it convert to dust? Well, you might have it would fragment, maybe. You'd have some gravel, maybe you have a little bit of dust, but would it thoroughly convert this concrete block to dust? Suppose you dropped a block from 1,000 feet, or from 1,360 feet, the height of these buildings. When it reached the ground, would there just be a pile of dust? I don't think so. I think you'd have gravel. So it's just a common sense idea. Where did the energy come from to convert these buildings into dust before they even got very far into this event? Now, the second proof, I think, is maybe the easiest to grasp, is that when you look at the way these buildings came down, here's the North Tower about 7 seconds into the event. And you can see that there's this center of destruction, which you can't even see. The building is being ripped apart in the center here. But you have all this mass that's falling through the air, and it's spreading out. So you have, it took this cloud of destruction about 13 to 15 seconds, or maybe 12 to 15 seconds to reach the ground, depending on whether you're looking at the bottom or the top of this cloud. And the destruction of the building is taking the same amount of time, or within that range of time, to reach the ground. Now, remember that it takes 9.2 seconds for an object drop from the roof of the tower to reach the ground. If it took 13 to 15 seconds, say, for these clouds to reach the ground, that means that the stuff falling outside the profile of the building was being slowed down just by air resistance by about, 30 to 60%. Now, if air could slow the progress of this falling debris down by 30 to 60%, then shouldn't have 1,000 vertical feet of intact steel structure that was strong enough to survive crosswinds of 120 miles an hour, strong enough to survive earthquakes, shouldn't that have slowed it down at least by, 100% or 1,000%? But yet, it's falling at the same rate. The building is being ripped apart invisibly inside of this thick cloud of dust at the same rate as the stuff that's falling through the air. It's clearly impossible. There's some force other than just the falling debris had to be ripping the building apart. And the third one, I encourage you to go to my website. It just measures the size of the dust cloud, and the dust cloud grew to easily 5 times the size of the building, the volume of the building within 30 seconds of the collapse, and it remained very distinct out to well past that point, suggesting that mixing accounted for very little of the expansion of this cloud. So you have this huge expansion of the cloud. There's only one way to explain that, and that's through the input of vast amounts of heat energy, either to vaporize latent water in the building, and water, when it vaporizes, expands a lot, or thermodynamic expansion, which a parcel of gas expands as you apply heat to it. And so I estimate that the total energy required to destroy these buildings is, conservatively speaking, about 1.5 gigawatt hours, which is already about 15 times the total gravitational potential energy of these buildings, which is supposedly the source of all this destruction, the energy source of all this destruction. So you have unaccounted energy going into this destruction. And the final proof is just to look at the curvature of, a couple of things about the South Tower. As we talked about how the South Tower tipped. Well, if you look at this picture, you can see not only is it tipping, it's actually curving. Well, how could this steel structure be like curving? Clearly, all this structure about 20 floors above the impact zone was already shattered even before the building started to fall. Now, according to the official explanation, the top is like this pile driver that's crushing the building. Well, some pile driver has already been shattered. And the other way of understanding this argument is that if you watch the video, you can see the top. It starts to tip, and then as it's falling, it stops. Rotational motion actually ceases and actually starts to rotate a little bit the other way. So you see a loss of angular momentum, but this is the only torque acting upon that piece. And the law of conservation of angular momentum says unless there's a torque acting in the opposite direction, it would tend to continue to rotate in that direction. But since it stopped, the only explanation I can think of is that the moment of inertia has been destroyed because that whole piece has just been pulverized, and then you don't have a solid object, you don't have a moment of inertia, so it doesn't contradict the law of the conservation of angular momentum. So I think I've used up all my time, and well, where's the, oh, WTC7.net, that stands for World Trade Center 7, just four letters, WTC7.net.
That was Jim Hoffman speaking at the International Grassroots Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11 last March in San Francisco. He has a website, WTC7.net, WTC7.net.
Paul Thompson is our next speaker. He comes to us all the way from New Zealand, although he's from California and a graduate of Stanford. His 9/11timeline.net, it's really an incredibly detailed, wonderful list of, you know, exactly what happened when, September 11th, and it's really important for the research and much respected. So I'd like to welcome Paul Thompson.
Hi there. I just want to say something before I begin my talk on Pakistan and its role in 9/11. And that is, in my 9/11 timeline, everything that's in the timeline, I use only mainstream sources, New York Times, Newsweek, that kind of thing. Not because I don't think that non-mainstream sources aren't valid, but just so that you can have the typical soccer mom in Kansas not question the sourcing and not question the material because they're doubtful of that. And when I'm talking today, everything I'm going to be saying is all coming from these types of sources. And if you listen to what I say, you might wonder, if you're not familiar with this material, how come I've never heard of any of this stuff before? How come I've never seen these reports? And that's because this material often gets in the mainstream, but in B17, you know, some sort of small mention in the back of the newspaper. And I wanted to mention an example from just a couple days ago in this whole Richard Clark information that's been coming out. One thing that came out of that was, it turns out that in the beginning of 1999, there was an attempt to kill Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. The attempt was foiled. They couldn't do it because it turns out that he was hunting with the royal family of the United Arab Emirates. And for a whole week, they were out with their falcons hunting in Afghanistan. And this, the fact that the royal family, there's a mention that we couldn't kill him because we would have killed half the royal family of the United Arab Emirates. The fact that they were meeting with bin Laden and sort of partying with bin Laden already after he's the number one terrorist in the world, after the African embassy bombings, this doesn't even really get a mention. It's just sort of, you know, just a little passing aside in the news reports. There's no questioning, what is this country that is one of our key allies in the Middle East, what are their leaders doing, you know, hanging out with the world's number one criminal? So we see things like this that do make it into the newspapers, but there's no commentary, there's sort of no follow-up. Another example of that, to sort of get onto the topic of Pakistan, I want to go also in 1999 to July. And there's a very interesting sting operation that the FBI and the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, was putting on at that point. They were trying to catch some arms dealers and some agents of the ISI, which is the Inter-Services Intelligence, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency. And so they were all at this restaurant within visual sight of the World Trade Center, and there was an informant named Randy Glass, and he was sitting with these ISI agents and arms dealers. And on all the nearby tables, you had FBI agents posing as other customers, and people were recording and videotaping all this for, you know, to later to catch these people. And there was one particular ISI agent who's named R.G. Abbas, and he pointed to the World Trade Center as they were eating and said, "Those towers are coming down," quote unquote, "those towers are coming down." This is in 1999. And he repeated this on two other occasions later on to emphasize the point that he was aware that there was a plot to not just attack the World Trade Center, but to completely destroy the World Trade Center. And this has made it into the mainstream media, but not very widely. We can see right there that there's clearly something going on with what the ISI knew about the plot and their role in the plot. I would like to not only talk about Pakistan's role in the plot, but also what that tells us about the role of the U.S. government potentially in the plot in 9/11. Because if we go back to the Afghan war in the 1980s fighting against the Soviets, we find that the ISI back at that time, at the beginning of the war, they were just like any other intelligence agency. They were nothing special. But the CIA really started pumping them up. I think we were watching a film last night here at the conference where there was some congressman saying that they were given several billion dollars a year, the Mujahideen rebels, from the CIA, from the Soviet, from the Saudis. Estimates range from $6 billion to $40 billion in the course of the war. And all that money went through the ISI, and they took out their corrupt slicing off of the top, and they became very fat and very rich on all that money. And not only that, but the ISI and the CIA also started working on promoting drugs and promoting the production and sale of opium, and which can be turned into heroin, in Afghanistan. I have a quote here from the Sydney Morning Herald that says, quote, "Opium cultivation and heroin production in Pakistan's northern tribal belt and adjoining Afghanistan were a vital offshoot of the ISI-CIA cooperation. It succeeded in turning some of the Soviet troops into addicts. Heroin sales in Europe and the U.S., carried out through an elaborate web of deception, transport networks, couriers, and payoffs, offset the cost of the decade-long war in Afghanistan," unquote. So very openly, and the CIA doesn't even really try to hide this, that they openly promoted the sale of the construction of a large transportation network of opium. And this also, the ISI, they were sort of like the running a protection racket on the whole thing. They were getting profits out of all that. And so until this day, they continue to do this. We don't know what the CIA role in that is, if that's still going, but we know at least the ISI continues to do this. As a result, they have their own budget, very powerful. They're called a state within a state. They've kicked out the leaders of Pakistan. They're sometimes more powerful than the leaders of Pakistan. And they're also a very scary bunch, the ISI. They are staffed with Wahhabists, which you may have heard is the very extremist form of Islam coming from Saudi Arabia. The Wall Street Journal said, quote, "Despite their clean chins and pressed uniforms, the ISI men are as deeply fundamentalist as any bearded fanatic. The ISI created the Taliban as their own instrument and still supports it," unquote. And they're not the only ones who are Wahhabist. This very expansionist version of Islam is basically there's a network between Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, and the Taliban. And those four countries really work together. And interestingly enough, many of you probably have heard of the BCCI scandal, the outlaw bank in the late 1980s. And these were the same countries that were very deeply involved in that scandal. And for instance, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates royal family, who we find out later is going hunting with bin Laden, they had the majority stake in that bank, Pakistani-owned bank. And some of the people involved in this nexus of these countries that I'm talking about were very interesting figures. One is Khalid bin Mahfouz, who gave money, very key amount of money, when George Bush Jr. was just beginning in his attempts in running an oil business back in the 1980s. And Khalid bin Mahfouz was 20% owner of BCCI. And he later on gave a whole bunch of money to bin Laden, so much so that about a couple years ago, the Saudi government actually had to put him under house arrest because his ties to bin Laden were so obvious. He's even married to bin Laden's sister. So there's these very interesting ties between these people and, you know, business ties and George Bush Jr. And I find this very fascinating, is that PBS Frontline, very mainstream source, they quote a French intelligence document which says that these same players from these same countries I mentioned, they were involved in the October surprise of 1980, successful attempt to put Bush and Reagan into power, and also in Iran-Contra, that there was money going from the Saudis to the Contras, And these same people who were taking part in that were people who later on would be big funders of Al-Qaeda. So in the 1990s then, in the early 1990s, the ISI created the Taliban in Afghanistan pretty much from scratch. The Taliban didn't exist. They gave them money, weapons, everything, sort of pushed them over the border, and they put them into power after a tremendous amount of support behind them. And it's pretty much accepted by all the mainstream media that the Taliban were the complete puppets of the ISI. And in fact, in June 2001, so just a few months before 9/11, several American reporters who were visiting the Taliban and even visiting Mullah Omar, the head, they noted that everything the Taliban had, their gasoline, their weapons, their telephone, even bottled water, everything they had came from the ISI, came from Pakistan. They also noted that all this material was being funded by the United Arab Emirates and by Saudi Arabia. So we continue to see a nexus of these countries working together on a Wahhabist expansionist goal. And in fact, on 9/11, those three other countries that I mentioned were the only countries to officially recognize the Taliban, which makes sense because Taliban was really the puppet of these various governments. So, for a very long time, to go on to a different sort of tangent, Pakistan has had a long-standing sort of Cold War with India over the province of Kashmir. And India has a much larger population, much bigger army. It's very difficult for Pakistan to compete with India over the issue of Kashmir. So what Pakistan has resorted to is they've resorted to terrorism as a method to sort of even up the battle, to have the Indian army defend against terrorists. You can have a small number of terrorists tie down a large number of soldiers. So what they did was they created number of terrorist organizations which were technically independent, but in fact secretly run by the ISI, often headed by people who are ex-ISI, but very recently ex. So this was a way to get a certain level of plausible deniability over what they were doing in Kashmir. And now what I would argue is that just as the ISI used terrorist fronts to accomplish its goals in Kashmir, Al-Qaeda is nothing more than a terrorist front for the ISI and for these other countries I mentioned in the international arena. And we can see a lot of evidence of this. The ties between the ISI and Al-Qaeda are very deep. I've already mentioned how the Taliban, which everybody associates with Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that those were puppets of the ISI. We see a lot of direct connections between these groups and Al-Qaeda. For instance, it's been estimated by mainstream media that several rich Saudis, including Khalid bin Mahfouz, I mentioned earlier, gave $500 million to Al-Qaeda in the 1990s. We talk about bin Laden having a fortune, but he couldn't have done nearly what he did if he didn't have a constant stream of revenue from the drugs that were being dealt with in Afghanistan and all the money that was coming from Saudi Arabia and his other supporters. And also, bin Laden personally could not have survived. Literally, he would have died if it wouldn't have been for ISI support, because bin Laden is a very sick individual, you could say in more ways than one, medically sick is what I mean. He has had for many years to rely on advanced medical equipment to survive. And in fact, CBS News had a very interesting story where they pointed out that the very day before 9/11, bin Laden was in a military hospital in Pakistan, and he was getting dialysis treatment guarded by the Pakistani military, completely surrounding the hospital and everything. And this was just the latest of many trips he made to get medical help like this. So they were very close allies. In fact, all these training camps you may have heard of in Afghanistan, we talk about them being Al-Qaeda training camps, but they're really just as much ISI training camps. When Clinton attacked them in 1998, it was very famous. Everyone said he was wagging the dog and so forth. He actually killed about 5 ISI leaders and about 20 ISI officers, and about 20 other ISI officials in that attack, because these training camps were being jointly run by Al-Qaeda and the ISI. So really we see it's virtually indistinguishable to see between the ISI, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda at this time. It's more of a semantic difference. So if we look, if we go back to Randy Glass, who I mentioned is part of the sting operation with talking about destroying the World Trade Center, you know, we can again see that here the ISI is buying materials, trying to buy Stinger missiles, trying to buy plutonium nuclear materials for bin Laden. And the sting operation ended in June 2001, and they tried to arrest some people. They didn't arrest the ISI agents, not surprisingly. The U.S. government did not. And Randy Glass was very concerned about some of this warning he'd gotten about the World Trade Center. So he started contacting people. He contacted his state senator. He contacted his national congressman. He contacted his national senator, and that was Bob Graham, a Democrat. He contacted others. This story has been covered a little bit by Dateline NBC, but unfortunately, it seems like not a lot of people have noticed that story. But fascinatingly, Bob Graham admitted that he was given this warning about the World Trade Center by Randy Glass before 9/11. He said, "I was aware of that warning and about a dozen others in the summer of 2001. Later on, he retracted that statement about a week later, but he did at one point admit to that. Ron Klein also admitted getting a similar warning and passing it on. He's the state senator, passing it on to U.S. intelligence agencies. So we see that the U.S. intelligence agencies were aware that the ISI was talking about destroying the World Trade Center. And then it gets real interesting. You have to keep your eye on Bob Graham, the senator, and also keep your eye on the director of the ISI, who's a person named Mahmoud Ahmed. And in May 2001, the CIA director, George Tenet, he went to Pakistan, and he met with President Musharraf, and he met with Mahmoud Ahmed. And then in the summer of 2001, the Crown Prince Abdullah, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, he secretly traveled to Afghanistan. He met with the Taliban and Mahmoud Ahmed. Then in late August, there's a report that the U.S. is in, quote, intense negotiations with the Pakistanis about bin Laden. Then at the end of August, we have Senator Bob Graham, Senator John Kyle, and Representative Porter Goss, who, by the way, is an ex-CIA agent. They travel to Pakistan. They meet with Musharraf. Things are kind of picking up. Events are picking up. Just a few days later, on September 4th, the ISI director, Mahmoud Ahmed, he comes to Washington, D.C., and he stays there all the way until 9/11. And just the day before 9/11, a Pakistani newspaper said that Mahmoud Ahmed has been having, quote, mysterious meetings with CIA Director George Tenet and those in the Pentagon and the National Security Council. And then it gets even more interesting. On the morning of 9/11, at the very time of the attacks, Mahmoud Ahmed is in Washington meeting with the same Bob Graham, John Kyle, and Porter Goss, who he'd met with in Pakistan a short time before. And they're discussing bin Laden, of all things, at the very moment the World Trade Center is hit. So Bob Graham, who's been given a warning that the ISI was wanting to attack the World Trade Center, he's sitting here with the head of the ISI when somebody comes in and hands him a note saying the World Trade Center has been hit by an airplane. So that's certainly interesting, I think, to say the least. So Mahmoud Ahmed went back to Pakistan. Pakistan was greatly rewarded. You know, you'd think maybe they would try to arrest this guy, you know, try to do something about the ISI. But in fact, they started giving Pakistanis all kinds of military aid, forgiving debts. And then we find out in a month later, there are news reports that come out. There's even a report in the Wall Street Journal that says that Mahmoud Ahmed personally ordered $100,000 to be sent to the head hijacker, Mohammed Atta, back when he was living in the U.S. So this was, not a whole lot of media coverage of this, but I said even the Wall Street Journal had a little story about this. So imagine here, we now know from this story, we have Bob Graham and other U.S. politicians sitting on the morning of 9/11 with one of the masterminds of 9/11 at the very time the attack happens. They're sitting just, you know, discussing things, having coffee, with a guy who ordered $100,000 to go to Mohammed Atta. So I think that's certainly very curious, especially if we look at this long history between the CIA and the ISI that stretches back 20 years, and involvement in, you know, like I said, October Surprise, Iran-Contra, these types of things. And now more recently, we're finding out that Pakistan is the same country that's been giving weapons of mass destruction, giving nuclear materials to North Korea, to Iraq, to Iran, to Libya, to just about anybody who wants it,